Howdy, and welcome to Texas Tribune's Tribcast. This is Tom Smitty Smith. I'm Director of Public Citizens Texas Office. Not to be confused with Evan Smith, that notorious noise polluter. And now, here's your host.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of September. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hi, Reeve.
Hello. Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And reporter Aman Bethesia.
Hi.
Did he pronounce your name right?
I have no idea. Aman?
The Aman part I think he got right.
We are going to talk about driving fast and committees in the Texas Senate, and then whatever we have time for after that.
We'll fight about redistricting again?
Yeah, I'd love to.
I think we should talk about that.
Yeah, was that a challenge?
Whenever we can fight about maps, let's fight
I'm
about
not them. The one throwing the punch in that story, but we'll get to that.
But let's start with driving fast. We all drove fast to be here at this podcast today, but maybe not as fast as you can in other places in Texas. Aman has been covering the move to 85 miles per hour.
That's about the worst intro ever.
The microphone stylings of Reeve Hamilton.
Also, plus he walked to work, so the whole conceit is not true.
I didn't walk to work today.
Did you drive today?
I did, but I do walk to work sometimes, which is not easy to do in all.
So what's up with this? What is up with the 85 mile? I mean, it seems...
In the last 3 days, I've driven to Houston and to College Station, and I would like to have gone 85 miles an hour. That would have
On the other hand, look to your left, look to your right when you're on any state road and ask yourself, do I want that guy driving 85?
Well, and the question is, do you think people are going to go 85 or are they going to see an 85 mile per hour speed limit?
What it
and
means
go 90,
is 90. In essence,
100.
The 85 mile an hour speed limit, you got to, you know, plus five.
People here in Austin always go 5 miles per hour under the speed limit.
It's like the Texas.
It drives me crazy. People in Austin drive so slow.
Well, you're riding behind me.
No, we just drove out to Marfa, though, which, I mean, there's a stretch there we can go 80, which previously was the fastest speed limit.
I told you to take 90 and not 10. You took 10.
We didn't have the time
to
take
10.
The scenic route.
Oh, my God. The mileage between Junction and Ozona and Sonora.
But you can go 300 miles an hour.
Holy
it's not so bad.
But it was great going 80. We hit that 80 stretch, and I thought it was, and I would have loved to go 5 miles faster.
But I think
what you
learned in driver's ed or back when your mama taught you to drive was it's not about you, it's about the other guy. And so the question is not whether you feel like you want to drive or can drive, right? But it's also, do you think it's a safe speed? By which you mean, do you think
I felt like I was far enough away from all the
other cars? The older Smith child is learning to drive, and dad's come out.
Shut up! I'm hoping to be frozen like Ted Williams' head until she has her license. Go ahead.
Respond. No, but seriously, this is
from a policy standpoint. I want to know.
This is drawing some real criticism.
Come on, national news.
Yeah, it made international news. There were like foreign TV stations.
Foreign.
It is
doing
weird
stories that Texans are crazy, right. And here's more proof.
Why does Phil Wilson hate America is the question.
It is weird that, you know,
who's Phil Wilson?
Not very long ago, the top speed
you
could go on
people.
A Texas road was 55. And you know, then they went back up to 70, and that was mildly controversial, and the insurance companies said, you know, it'll cost a lot, and you know, the environmentalists said, you know, you'll gulp up more gasoline if you're driving semis that fast. And then they did the West Texas thing, I guess, was kind of the first one, the 80-mile-an-hour I-10 from Junction to Fort Stockton or whatever that
stretches. And it's the only, presently, it's the only 80-mile-an-hour speed limit in Texas, right? 75 is more common, but 80 is limited to I-10.
Right. And when you're on a 75, I mean, I was in a couple of those, you know, in the last few days. Everybody's going 78 or 82. It's all sort of, you know, 75 dude around.
This is Aman's point. So if the cops are not prepared to ticket people, right, this was your point.
Did he get a word? He did. Yeah.
I thought I heard him.
Thank you for joining us, Aman.
Didn't you say people are not going to go 80? They're going to go, or 85, they're going to go faster.
Well, but this road had been in the works for like 2 years. The legislature last session passed a bill that gave TxDOT the authority to make a road 85 miles per hour if it was designed to handle that. And this stretch of 130 from Austin to Seguin is supposedly has been engineered to handle that. It's
and it's
straight,
a toll
it's
and it's
flat.
A toll road.
Yes.
But let's be clear that you don't have to do this. You can elect to take
But why do they want to do this? Why do they want an 85 mile an hour road?
Isn't it to attract people to pay the toll?
Well, also TxDOT really wants people to use this toll road, not only because they make some money off it, they get a share of toll revenue, but also they want to get roads in San Antonio and Austin less congested. So they want this road to be as attractive as possible. And also in the contract with the private firm that's building and going to operate the toll road for 50 years, it said if they set the toll, if they set the speed limit at 80, they get $67 million lump sum payment. And if they set it at 85, they get $100 million lump sum payment. So that's generated a lot of the controversy, the idea that TxDOT was basically paid to make it 85 miles per hour.
And there's another controversy. Am I correct about this, or did I dream this? That there's some discussion of what the speed limit is on the frontage roads.
Right.
So that they will incentivize, awful word, people to take the toll roads and therefore pay. They're making the speed limit on the on the non-toll portion of that so low that it's unattractive for people to not take the toll road.
Before the toll road was there, it was 183. It was four lanes and no divider or anything. It was considered a pretty dangerous road because it was 65 miles per hour. And now it's 183 is the frontage roads on both sides. And it TxDOT set it at 55 miles per hour, which it's safer, but it now has a lower speed limit. And also causing controversy, this Ben Ware at the Statesman found out that an engineer with the company that is building the toll road is the one that did the test run that determined the speed limit on those frontage roads.
Gee, I wonder how that turned out.
So the county commissioners in Caldwell County and the city of Lockhart City Council have all asked and passed resolutions saying we think it should be 65 miles per hour. And they're all convinced that this was done.
65 instead of 85?
No, I'm sorry.
This is the frontage road.
This is the frontage road. 65 instead of 55.
They think the frontage road should be 65, and they're convinced that it was set at 55 in order to push people to use the toll road. The company that's building a toll road, they say that it's one of the reasons 55 makes more sense is because there's going to be a lot of economic development and they don't want people coming out of parking lots onto the frontage road at 65 miles per hour.
What do the insurance companies say about this? Have you had a chance to poke those guys, see what
there's a national insurance group, which his name I'm forgetting at the moment, that has come out against it.
Institute for Highway Safety?
Yes.
Right.
And they've come out strongly against it and said that it's too high and it's going to cause... a lot of the studies show that higher speed limits cause more severe accidents. There's some debate over whether higher speed limits cause more accidents or more fatal accidents.
It's just that the accidents that you do have are more likely to be fatal accidents.
More severe at least.
It does seem like the toll roads... in this state are becoming more of a regular fact of life, right? There was a charm on the charm bracelet aspect.
I would say have become. I think that's over. A regular deal.
So now, I live in West Austin, and I occasionally have to go, as I did the other day, to Tyler or somewhere north Fort Worth, and I have the option of crossing town and getting on I-35 and going north from downtown. Or now I have the option of going MOPAC and connecting with 45, getting onto the tolled portion of MOPAC north of the Domain, and then going on 45 over and paying whatever it is, 75 cents. It is fast as hell to do it that way.
It's pretty sweet.
I think that, I was not necessarily for or against tolls before. I was sympathetic to the argument that you're being double taxed, that basically you pay for the roads once, then you're asked to be paying for them again. So I was kind of like, I don't know how much I feel like there's not like this until I started doing it on a regular basis. And I thought, all right, now I get it now. So I guess the fact that it's an option for people, they're not obligated to do it, lets the state off the hook on some levels in terms of requiring people to put their hands in their pockets.
Yes and no. But, if you want to get around congestion and the price of getting around congestion is put yourself
cents.
In harm's way with a bunch of, all the other idiots, like you say.
And a couple bucks.
Texting at 85 miles an hour.
Let me take the other side of that, which is it's a free country. You don't have to do that. You can decide to go 55 on 183.
Yeah, you could stay in the congestion on an I-35, but you can't. Should you be able to safely go around it
but if you're willing to pay for it? Remind me which of the Bill of Rights, where in the Bill of Rights does it say I have the right not to be in congestion?
I sounded like my constitution.
Suddenly I had this vision of myself as David Simpson. I was suddenly talking about liberty.
I got stuck on pursuit of happiness in there somewhere.
Is that what it was?
Maybe that was me.
I think that was the pursuit of the guy in front of you is what it
was. I think there's a car website called jalopnik.com, and someone pointed me to
this is part of the Gawker family of websites.
Matt Hardegree, our
very classy.
First shout out to him on the podcast.
Good. Well, one of their writers wrote something about 85 miles per hour, and he made a great point. He said that the German Autobahn, there's no speed limit, and I think the average speed that people tend to drive on that is like about 83, 84 miles per hour. And he said the distinction is in the Autobahn is driven by Germans. A Texas Autobahn is going to have Texas drivers, and that terrifies me.
A lot of Texans are of German descent.
One of the questions here, is the owner of
raise the speed limit.
The owner of a Honda, Civic. One of the issues here is, will my car go 85 miles?
I can personally attest to the fact that my vehicle goes that fast. And
well, how about that?
Evan Smith answering the questions everyone's asking.
Officer, stay away from me. I don't know how I feel about it. I do think that it's funny from a news standpoint, though, that everyone's going, oh, it's so much like Texas to do this. It's just, it's the transportation version of that character on The Simpsons. Pow, pow, pow. Right. It's like everyone just has this caricature idea of us
right.
as somehow just big really and reckless and irresponsible, and look at us. And
But of course, I've never been on a road where you could go more than 60 miles an hour without hitting something. I mean, they're all from the congested part of America, It's like we have open highways here.
And also, in lots of those parts of America, every road is a toll road, basically. So in some ways, it's not at all like Texas.
Right. It's not the Jersey Turnpike.
Is it possible that the health risks could eventually cut down the financial gains of the, if we have so many accidents, will our health costs
eliminate that? If it turns out to be, if it turns out to be one of those, dead man's curve type of a road.
Death Race 2000 kind of thing. Right. Yeah.
Then I'm sure, something will happen. Well, I mean, there's going to be an EMT story. There's going to be a hospital story. There's going to be an insurance story.
First time somebody flips their car on the way to Seguin, going, 90 or whatever.
Right.
We're going to hear, oh, it's the toll road.
Do you send an ambulance? Do you send a hearse? It's going to be one of those kinds of things.
Well, and TxDOT has said this is an interim speed limit. It could change, especially once the road opens.
It could go even higher.
Of course. Let's come back to however.
Can your car go higher?
Than what?
85?
I expect probably can. let's come back to, however briefly we come back to this, the policy question that's at the front of the line here, which is, do we have an adequate mechanism to pay for roads? We wouldn't need toll roads if we had enough money to pay for roads.
Well, that's a mechanism for paying for roads. It's just it's just a way to do it.
When I was in Tyler on Monday at our event with David Simpson and Kevin Eltife, unlike many of the legislators I've interviewed over the last year in their home districts, talk about what are the big issues of the session. They talk about public ed, and they talk about water and everything else. He talked about TxDOT right off the bat and said, I think it's absurd that we have all these bonds. We ought to just have a gas tax. If we're going to have bonds, we ought to have a gas tax. I would rather let's just call it what it is. We're basically levying a charge on people to pay for it. He was really like hot under the collar about TxDOT stuff. This is a sleeper issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue that cuts across traditional ideological groups. At a time when we have no money to pay for the things that we all talk about, public ed and everything else, this is another massive unfunded expense. What did Deirdre DeLisi say a couple of years ago? It was a $315 billion road funding hole to maintain current roads at the current level of congestion for the next 20 years. Well, the current level of congestion is DOA as a concept because population is growing as fast as it is, and we need not only better roads than the ones we have now, but more of them.
A famous man once said, where in the Constitution do you have a right not to be in a congested road?
That guy's a jerk, whoever said that.
Are you going to tell us who Phil Wilson was?
Phil Wilson is the fourth member of Wilson Phillips. Phil Wilson is the head of TxDOT.
Is he looking forward to the session at this point?
I'm looking at my transportation reporter. Keep up. Is he looking forward to the session? Well, probably, because would I rather be Phil Wilson or Michael Williams going into the session? Would I rather be Phil Wilson or the chancellors of any of the public universities?
Would I rather
be Phil Wilson or Kyle Janik? I'd rather be Phil Wilson.
Now you have to say who all those other
people
are.
No, I don't.
Well, I mean, the central problem that faces these guys as they go into this next session is how are you going to pay for the things that you promised, or are you going to cut back on the things that you promised? And one of the things where they really have that question in present tense is, we promised to build you roads, but we also promised not to raise your taxes. Discuss. And that's where we get toll roads, and that's where we get all of this, where we get this whole conversation.
Of course, the other half of the story with Eltife very quickly was that I said at the end of the conversation with Eltife and David Simpson, Kevin Eltife and David Simpson were the guests at this event at UT Tyler, was, well, demographic inevitability is this thing that nobody at the legislature talks about, to my mind at least, adequately. The population change is not coming, it's here, and the it's not just the numbers, but it's also the composition of the population, and where the population is growing in particular are in areas of the state where we have historically underinvested in things like education and health, but also in infrastructure. So you have all these people streaming into the valley, but the roads in the valley may not be up to the numbers that are now coming. And they looked at me and they said, no, we don't think actually that the population change means anything, that, you know, everybody deserves good roads, everybody deserves good schools. Their whole attitude was that the population change is not going to cause, in this instance, for instance, a need for a lot more investment in roads in the valley. I wonder if that's in fact true.
Well, and the other thing that every transportation expert is terrified about is that cars keep getting more fuel efficient. So the gas tax, which already is a terrible source of income
right.
for roads,
it's going to become worse because everybody drives a Prius, then we're screwed.
Right.
Right.
So that's how we get the battery tax, right?
Right.
Emily just bought a new fuel-efficient car.
It's Kate Galbraith's fault. It's all these green tree huggers, Prius huggers. That's the problem.
This is why I did not walk to work today.
Because you wanted
to help the state.
You were doing your duty.
Yeah.
Right.
Who's going to be the chair of the transportation committee in the Senate?
I don't know. I mean, one of the conversations, you know, we're waiting for David Dewhurst to name the rest
who
of the committee.
Who has it been?
It has been
Tommy Williams.
Tommy Williams
is not going to be it now.
Finance. Right.
So, and it's not going to be Kirk Watson probably, right?
There's a conversation, you know, one senator is a former transportation.
He's vice chairman. Watson's vice chairman presently.
Right. Watson's vice chairman. Robert Nichols is a former transportation commissioner.
I bet it's Nichols.
He's a possibility.
I bet it's
Chuy
Nichols.
Hinojosa is a possibility here. We're waiting for David Dewhurst.
Chuy has to win.
We're waiting. He's going to win. We're waiting for the rest of
heard it here
the,
first.
I get crap for talking about Cruz winning, and you get. But it's okay to talk about Hinojosa
right.
winning?
Right.
Okay.
Ross drives the speed limit.
I'll tell Raul. I will direct all of Raul
really
Torres' phone calls to you.
I don't know if my car goes 85 miles an hour.
Right.
The Mini Cooper I used to drive did go 85 miles an hour. I will say that. So Dewhurst named Tommy Williams to head the finance committee, and he said, I'll do the rest of the reorganization of the Senate as we go forward. As we know, he's going to have a more conservative Senate than he had.
The most conservative Senate of all time.
He's got some issues in front of him. The education committee's opened. Florence Shapiro is leaving, and Dan Patrick really wants that job and has put a marker down saying vouchers will be the voter ID of the next session. So
And Dewhurst has said, I'm supporting vouchers.
If Dewhurst, right. And he also said, let me see the details before I fully commit to that. So Dewhurst is in a position of, if I name Dan Patrick, am I endorsing the voucher thing? That's one issue. Does he need to go with Dan Patrick because that's the conservative way, yada, yada, yada. Kel Seliger is another name that's been mentioned for that. There's a subplot here about whether Dewhurst will recombine the Higher Education Committee chaired by Judy Zaffarini with the Education Committee, or whether he'll
I love when you call her Judy. Those,
or leave those. Evan prefers Judith.
It's very intimate.
Senator Zaffarini, how's that? whether Zaffarini will still have a committee, or whether she'll be, you know, the chairman of a subcommittee or a member of a subcommittee under education, and all the political implications of that. So we're kind of waiting. But it sort of goes to this whole issue of the Senate's going to be more conservative. How does this manifest itself? And one way it's going to manifest itself is, you know, David Dewhurst surveys the landscape. Here are the new senators. Here's what happened to me in the election against Ted Cruz. What do I need to do now? And well, they've said it's imminent, so we could find this out, you know, in the next couple of days or in the next couple of weeks.
We could have gotten the email right. When we were talking about speeding.
Right.
Isn't there talk of all Republican chairs?
There was some talk of all Republican chairs. This is something Bullock
did. In fact, Paxton said the other day in the Trib Live that he would be okay with that.
You know, when the Senate had 22 or 23 Democrats and Bob Bullock was the lieutenant governor, he did this in 91. And the Republicans who were there showed him the other way. they basically hit the brakes and turned the Senate into molasses. Bullock was a famous efficiency freak, and it drove him crazy. And by late March or early April, he'd gone back to Ike Harris, a senator from Dallas, who'd been the senator he busted, and said, please stop doing this to me. I'll take care of you. And never did that again.
If Dewhurst does something to Senator Zaffarini, she will make it hard on
him. She'd be a very dangerous person to idle. I mean, if she was mad at you and had time on her hands, she could really mess up.
She's a workhorse.
The business. She works her tail off. She's very smart. She's got a lot of experience. She was there and watched how Ike Harris did it to Bullock. So she knows how. I mean, and so the question for Dewhurst is, if I do make the Senate committee assignments more conservative and I do this to Judith Zaffarini, what will it cost?
What it's going to cost is Zaffarini
right. messing with you every
single
day.
Being mad.
Right. Well, I mean, and she can be mad in a way that... I think it's more than her being mad.
Well, yes, it's more than that, but allow me to focus on that for the moment. It's going to be, you know, Punch and Judy, basically. Right. You know, she's going to be mad as can be.
And, there go the Christmas and the problem cards. For Dewhurst is that he would have to be Punch.
Yeah, true.
I mean, that would that'd be tough.
You mentioned that Ken Paxton at your Trib Live event last week was for this, but I was surprised Larry Taylor and Hancock were not as enthusiastic about the idea of all Republican
chairs. Well, they were not, you know, and I think they were just bowing to the reality of the way the Senate has operated in, you know, in a something approaching congenial manner over time. You know, we have discussed, Ross and I have discussed kind of offline from the podcast, is the assumption that the Senate is going to be so conservative a correct one?
Right.
With the addition of Schwertner and Hancock and Paxton and now Donna Campbell and Taylor and possibly Mark Shelton, depending upon the outcome of that Senate District 10 race, you've viewed Taylor possibly as the one of the group.
Taylor's had a great
who
ability.
May not just sort of lurch.
He's had an ability in the House, and this is why he was sort of the head of the caucus. He's been able to work with both sides. You know, he hasn't put on his jersey and sort of touted his team to the extent of always running the other team down. He put himself in the position of being the guy the Democrats could talk to, clearly a Republican, clearly conservative, but able to straddle the line and able to talk to both sides. And I just don't think that he's been a 100%er in the same way that some of the others have been. You know, he's probably a 90%er or a 93%er. You know,
look,
does Michael Quinn Sullivan know that?
You're going to have he will
he
now.
Does, actually, yeah.
You're going to have a Senate that has undeniably more movement conservatives in it. The number can be argued about, but you're going to have many more movement conservatives in it than you did, say, last session when, you know, arguably Dan Patrick and Brian Birdwell were the two true movement conservatives. You know, Robert Nichols conservative, Tommy Williams conservative, Jane Nelson conservative, but a different brand of conservative. The addition of Hancock and Paxton and Donna Campbell, and I would argue probably Schwertner, means that you're going to have a much beefier conservative caucus within the Republican caucus in the Senate. And that the upshot of that is going to be that Dewhurst is going to have decisions to make going all the way back to now when he makes committee assignments,
right,
but certainly as he goes forward into the session. Dewhurst's, for all practical purposes, Dewhurst's soft political underbelly was exposed during both the runoff and the primary that preceded it. The knock against Dewhurst was he wasn't conservative enough, fair or unfair. That's what ultimately got him
that was
beat.
The Ted Cruz flag.
Right.
Right.
And so now
so
he's
goes
going to
into
fill his
session.
Soft political underbelly with beef.
No. What?
Reeves hungry.
I think. Note to self, never record the podcast right before lunch. No, the problem for Dewhurst is if he either is not that person who Cruz said he was, or he is. And if he is the more traditional business conservative as opposed to movement conservative that Cruz successfully painted him as during the primary and the runoff, he goes into this session wondering, how am I going to be able to control this unruly bunch? Am I going to be able to lead a Senate that is dominated, if not numerically, then philosophically, by the movement guys?
Right.
If he is that person, he's going to have a lot of work to do to prove it because he didn't successfully prove it during this. And that may cause him to overcompensate.
Well, and is he really truly, I mean, he said he wants to run for re-election. Is he saying that, you know, this is the question all the time.
Yeah.
Is he saying that because he's... doesn't want to be a lame duck, or is he saying that because he wants to run again?
Is he feinting right to remain relevant, or does he really intend to run again?
If he does intend to run again, he's going to have to reconvince these voters who put him in office and then rejected him for the U.S. Senate seat. It's going to be the Republican primary voters again, and they've already turned him down once, and they've already provided any opponent that he might get with a roadmap for how to beat him. You know, just behave like Cruz, right?
Well, and another issue that came up a lot during the race wasn't just that he isn't conservative enough, but that he caves under pressure. So even if he takes these positions on the right, he has to show that he could actually pass something, because if not, he'll just get blamed for it and he'll get accused of having caved again.
He caves under the wrong pressure. Right?
But let me tell you what I think. Tell you what I think as a practical matter, just in one instance that was interesting, at least to me, this may mean. So I asked about immigration, or immigration was asked about, I should say. I think it came up in the questions at the Trib Live event last week to Paxton and Hancock and Taylor. And we kind of, the conversation got to quickly the question of in-state tuition, which, if you recall, was a big flashpoint during the presidential campaign. Perry, I think very bravely, came out and said, look, our position in Texas has been to be compassionate to the children of undocumented persons, and we have in-state tuition. He was roundly booed from both on stage and off stage during that debate. It has long been the law and policy of this state to provide in-state tuition rates to the children of undocumented persons. Hancock, Paxton, and Taylor all, and I acknowledge it was not totally without my prodding them because they were not like racing
right.
to say it.
Taylor initially said, you know, I wasn't there when they made this decision back in the early thousands. And,
but
you know,
then
I
when I
the
but when I pressed him to say, you got to say yes or no, he said I would be against it. And Taylor joined Hancock and Paxton. Well, Eltife, who in the Senate coming is not among the most conservative people. I mean, right. I think we all acknowledge Eltife has been not in the Patrick Birdwell camp as a movement guy. Eltife's attitude was, we can't afford to do this. He was against it. We'll post video of the Eltife Simpson thing in a day or two.
When he says afford, does he mean
we don't have
the state money, or does he mean politically to survive?
No, he means the former. Generally speaking, the Eltife's point through this entire conversation was, we don't have enough money to do all the things that people want us to do, and we're never going to again.
Right.
We have to make choices. We don't have the money to give these tuition breaks to people whose, you know, maybe they're children of illegal persons, and therefore they're, or undocumented persons, and so therefore they're not themselves the one who committed the act. But, you know, stuff has consequences, right?
Yeah, and but so, the argument for it is an economic argument that if you don't help them move up, then they will drag down the economy.
Well, and the reality is, Julian or somebody else here has reported on a study that showed the economic impact of simply escorting all the people who are undocumented to the border. The economic impact on the state would be quite significant in a right. negative sense.
Right.
But his position, Eltife's, along with Hancock's and Taylor's and Paxton, is we ought to look at in-state tuition again. If it comes up, I would be willing to overthrow it. You know, look, we're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, this Senate is going to be something. And what? The House has traditionally been the conservative, you know, they say the Senate is the saucer that cools the cup. I think we're all cup this session. I think it's all cup.
Well, I think, you know,
no
saucers. More to the point, this legislature is going to be really, really price sensitive. Everything's about money. Yep. Everything is about, true. You know, can we afford to do that program? And every program that they don't want to do, they will position as a high-priced program. And everything that they do want to do, they'll say, you know, this really isn't as expensive as it looks and maybe does some good on the other hand. So when you
and
want to knock something out,
it may be things like family right. planning last session, which if you recall,
right.
a lot of the people who talked about moving money away from Planned Parenthood positioned it initially as a way to save money, but all they were doing was basically shifting it from the thing they right. don't like to crisis pregnancy centers or whatever else the thing that they do like.
So sort of the baseline thing with
voters. You've got to watch what they say and what they do.
Right. The baseline thing with Republican voters right now, and has been since late 2008, early 2009, is the Tea Party stuff. And that's a price-sensitive party, taxed enough already. This is all, you know, sort of in the way that things 20 years ago tagged back to the religious right and to social conservatism, things now tack back to fiscal conservatism and the Tea Party and things like that. And I think that's how they're going to couch all these conversations.
But this tuition thing to Tea Party groups is not really about money.
No, but that's the way it'll get argued, because that's an effective way to argue it in the legislature. We're spending X amount on this. We don't have X amount. Let's stop doing it.
Perry tried to argue it in emotional terms, calling Republicans that didn't support it heartless.
Right.
And that did not go well for him.
Well,
and everybody took that lesson, I think.
But yeah. I heard it come up a lot in different Republican primaries and Tea Party group meetings around the state. And it was brought up as an issue of fairness and not money. And I'm guessing that they're going to be pushing that a lot this session.
Mm-hmm. They thought it was unfair?
Issue. Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were sounding like they really want to see this repealed this session. This is going to be a really high priority issue for a lot of the Tea Party groups.
If you put it to an actual vote in the House and in the Senate, that's a politically very difficult thing.
Well, the House and the Senate that approved in-state tuition right. is not this House.
Well,
this
that's what I'm saying. If you put this issue just straight up in front of this House and Senate, I don't see how they pass
it. Perry signed it twice already.
You know, I think the issue this time would not be would Perry sign it. I think it would ever get to Perry's desk
right.
to sign. I question whether it would.
But you don't, even if it did, would he sign it? Or would he?
I think he'd have to sign it because he'd be hypocritical given how much.
We mean getting rid of it.
He impaled his presidential campaign on that sword.
Yeah, but he's.
Sword,
I mean,
he has hinted
that he's not through looking at presidential campaigns. That would be a very interesting moment. You know, if he wants to run, if Romney loses and he wants to run again.
Before I was against it.
I've listened to the voters and I heard what they said.
All right, well.
All right, if you have heard anything that we said that you'd like to comment on, please email tribcast@texastribune.org. In the meantime, on behalf of Evan, Amon, Ross, and our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
I love America. America.
I love America. I love America. I'm sticking with I love America. George-